Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, most of us heard this somewhere in school, right? DNA, the code of life, the double helix, Watson and Crick, messenger RNA makes the proteins that somehow put themselves together to become us. Yeah, right. Well, as I'm fond of saying, the devil's in the details. And in this week's pre-recorded episode of Ask Dr. Dawn, we are going to go into those details and wander around, kick the tires, and imagine what might already be possible and what might be possible in the near future. So fasten your seatbelts and let's begin. Endonucleases, or enzymes that cleave DNA after a certain sequence of nucleotides, has been read were the breakthrough science of the 70s that ultimately allowed the Human Genome Project to map all human genes. But then we found to our surprise that there were only about 30,000 genes, less than those found in many much more primitive organisms. Clearly, there is a much higher level of control with ongoing editing and overlapping sequences that are somehow unscrambled in an elaborate decoding and editing process that we are far from understanding. Epigenetics, a topic regular listeners have heard much about here on Ask Dr. Dawn, is certainly a part of this. But in today's program, we'll be delving into crunching the genetic code, among other things, using a little device called CRISPR. But before we dive into the deep basic sciences, let's talk about some practical applications of all this basic research to justify why we need to keep funding it as a public and not a private enterprise. DNA and RNA in the blood. Some of you may have heard of Stanford bioengineer Stephen Quake. It was him in 2008 that discovered that it's possible to non-invasively detect fetal chromosomal abnormalities by testing the mother's blood. In other words, tiny bits of fetal DNA are circulating in the mother's bloodstream. No need for amniocentesis, chorionic villus sampling. In fact, all you need is a simple blood test. And it's estimated that in 2013, hundreds of thousands of pregnant women used a version of Quake's test to learn more about the health of their fetuses. In fact, in 2012, Stephen Quake showed that it's possible to sequence an entire fetal genome just from a maternal blood sample. Well, his lab is now looking at something even more immediate and potentially more important, RNA. The information that we get from DNA sequences is mostly static. It tells us the sequence of the genes, the blueprint, if you will, for the book of life. But RNA levels and messages change markedly among tissues over time, and during embryological development, it's possible to actually track where in the process of development a fetus is. Quake's group was able to identify and analyze circulating fetal RNA molecules in the pregnant woman's blood. They were able to separate those which came from her own organs from those of the fetus, and they were able to trace the development of fetal brain, liver, and placental through all three trimesters simply by analyzing these blood samples. This could allow for an unprecedented level of prenatal diagnosis. We might be able to identify renal or liver problems caused potentially by all sorts of inborn errors of metabolism that we could then address in utero. the dynamic information about the pregnancy could also tell us when a fetus was being stressed, or if a maternal fever or viral infection, or even a pharmaceutical, was possibly endangering the fetus and needed to be stopped. This doesn't just stop with pregnancy, however. Analyzing your RNA, which, by the way, comes out in your urine and can thus be accessed very easily without a blood sample, is a way to screen you for diseases, monitor your diseases, and potentially give us an early warning signal on a host of things, being able to nip problems in the blood almost before they get started. As I said earlier, the Human Genome launched a host of projects to smoke out the genetic causes of the diseases, but it's been very frustrating. There seem to be too many suspects in genome-wide association studies, 70, 80, maybe 100 potential genes causing a disease. These would need to be tested by trial and error. New evidence suggests, however, that the culprits in disease are genes driving the bus, that is to say, control genes. And chromatin marks the spot in the search for disease pathways. It turns out that there are a lot of genes out there that are not protein-coding genes at all, but rather regulatory genes. In a surprise study published online in Nature Genetics in December of 2013, a group showed that genetic variations that are associated with diseases tend to cluster near specific sites called chromatin marks. These are biochemical modifications of the proteins that package DNA inside the cell. These chromatin marks can serve as a sort of genetic guidepost, indicating that gene regulation may be taking place nearby. The genes clustering around these marks are highly represented in genetic disease variants. And by looking in these locations, the hangouts, if you will, of the really important disease-related genes, researchers can narrow the field and refine their searches for the genetic culprits of a wide variety of diseases. For example, single nucleotide polymorphisms, that's to say, one A to G or C to T change, a tiny, tiny alteration in the sequence of DNA, can control diseases such as high cholesterol, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and a variety of psychiatric diseases. With respect to diabetes, for example, the chromatin markers for both liver and pancreatic islet cell tissue were among the genes that have been implicated in the genome-wide association studies. Ultimately, the goal of such research is to identify the genes that need to be modulated. And we'll be talking for the rest of this program about how we might achieve that sort of modulation. In the past, we've talked about methylation and histone acetylation as two extremely important aspects of epigenetic control of DNA transcription. But microRNA is another important player in epigenetics. MicroRNA regulates which genes are being made into protein after they've managed to be transcribed from DNA into messenger RNA. MicroRNA was a member of a non-coding family of molecules, of RNA molecules, known as junk RNA. These microRNAs are about 20 to 25 nucleotides long, and they make up about as much as 10% of the non-coding RNAs found in cells. They were first identified about 20 years ago and thought to only be found in worms and yeast, but over the last decade, not only have they been found in most living cells, but they have a huge influence on biological process and human disease. MicroRNAs are important in the normal functioning of cells and regulate numerous biological functions, including basic cell signaling and tissue architecture. They act by attaching to the 3' end of messenger RNA molecules, and they impair protein translation. In some cases, they actually tag messenger RNA for degradation. So effectively, the genes are being transcribed dutifully into messenger RNA, and that messenger RNA is leaving the nucleus, going out into the cytoplasm of the cell, and then being tagged by these small interfering RNAs, these microRNAs, to essentially get recycled. Sorry, we don't need you. MicroRNAs turn out to be extremely important in diabetic kidney disease. Now, here's what we know from our histologic studies and biopsies. After about 5 to 10 years, the kidneys change in people who have poorly controlled diabetes. The kidney undergoes an increase in collagen production, which causes its structure to become fibrotic and scarred and decreases its ability to act as a filter. Something about the high glucose environment, along with factors such as transforming growth factor beta, drive this collagen and matrix protein production, but it hasn't been understood before. Several microRNAs are regulated by TGF-beta and essentially are downregulated. There are 5 or 6 primary microRNAs that are altered in kidney disease. Most of these are decreased. And what appears to happen is that these microRNAs are important for preventing collagen from being produced in the kidney. And when they disappear, the kidney is no longer protected from collagen formation and becomes scarred, and diabetic kidney disease is the result. The implication for therapeutic prevention of kidney disease is obvious. If we can find a way to either upregulate or actually insert these microRNAs into renal cells, we might be able to stop kidney disease from developing even in poorly controlled diabetics. MicroRNA fragments create epigenetic change, and they may be one of the important ways that genes change in descendants. A multitude of modern illnesses have been attributed to epigenetic inheritance. In other words, stresses experienced by parents or grandparents can be passed on to the next or even the second generation after. And this has been implicated in schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and obesity. But the detailed mechanisms of this have yet to be fully elucidated. One group, the laboratory of Isabelle Mansuy of the University of Zurich in Switzerland and her colleagues, have been looking at a mechanism in mice that is really quite fascinating. MicroRNAs, as I've said, live in the cytosol of cells, and Mansuy's group has identified that excess microRNA molecules in the sperm from adult mice who were stressed as pups from separation from their mothers at birth actually transmit in the sperm, and a very small amount of them manage to make their way into the ovum and affect the behavior of the offspring, both at the children and the grandchildren. These molecules can be detected in the cytosol, and it appears that the experience of the fathers as pups actually passes into their sperm, which of course are being created throughout their life. And these behavioral influences, by the way, show up in the mouse fathers as follows. They are more daring, more likely to take risks, but they also give up more easily when placed in a frustrating situation. The typical situation that's used experimentally is to put the mice in a tank where they have to swim around until they find an underwater platform that they can climb up onto. Mice vary quite a bit in terms of their willingness to keep swimming, and some will swim to the point of complete exhaustion, whereas others will give up early and sink to the bottom, apparently prepared to just drown. Well, that behavior comes through in the offspring and the grandchildren of mice who were deprived of maternal stimulation at birth. Just to make sure that it was microRNA, Mansui's lab took purified extracts of microRNA from the stressed mice and injected them into normal mouse embryos. When born, these mice had the same abnormal behavior as the stressed mice, whereas those who were injected with a control RNA did not. This comes very close to proving that the behavior was transmitted by these microRNAs, presumably by preventing the production of normal levels of certain neurotransmitters. Makes you think about that biblical verse about the sins of the fathers, doesn't it? MicroRNA showed a lot of promise initially, and everyone was very excited about it, but it turned out, well, not to be an immediate moneymaker for big pharma. And so a lot of small companies that had promising products were bought up, and then later on the research shut down when the large pharmaceutical corporations took a look at the development cycle and realized that they weren't going to get an immediate cash cow out of the enterprise. Small biotech companies are where this research needs to be. But indeed, that is the platform that is delivering some very, very interesting work. A company in Cambridge, Massachusetts called Alnylam just announced its first major success, a microRNA-based treatment that drastically reduced levels of a toxic liver protein in people with a rare neurodegenerative disease. One of the chief difficulties in making small interfering RNA surgery work is getting the RNA into the cell. New technologies involving intravenous infusions of small RNAs packaged into lipid nanoparticles has solved the problem, at least so far as liver diseases are concerned. This has to do with the fact that the liver is uniquely capable of endocytosis, that is to say, taking up small particles like these lipid particles and doing something with them. The other cell line where this particular type of strategy is likely to prove successful is in the immune system, as many of our immune cells are designed to engulf and digest particles, that is to say, bacteria. And if we can mimic the bacteria with lipid nanoparticles, we should be able to achieve high levels of interfering RNA in the cytosol, which is where the action is. And we don't have to penetrate the nucleus. Getting DNA into the nucleus of the cell is truly the holy grail of therapy, and it's something that we've not been able to achieve very effectively with viral vectors and various other strategies. So finding a lever, a mechanism that we can use that happens in the cytoplasm of the cell is just huge. Just to get specific, the Alnylam company's microRNA was able to reduce the blood levels of the protein in question by 96%. They only had an N of 29 people because this is an orphan disease, but it's an extremely powerful proof of concept. Another place where RNA interference may be extremely effective is in cancer therapy. Using a technique known as nucleic acid origami, chemical engineers have built tiny particles out of DNA and RNA, and these can deliver these small microRNAs directly into tumors, turning off genes expressed in cancer cells. Nanoparticles can be tagged with molecules of folic acid. It turns out that tumors have vastly upregulated levels of folic acid receptors on their surfaces. So a particle that has a folic acid tag on its surface will tend to attach preferentially to the cancer cells. Because these are lipid nanoparticles, they then fuse to the cell wall and deliver the interfering RNA into the cytoplasm. Researchers at the David Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research at MIT, partnering with Alnylam Pharmaceuticals, have been able to generate effective therapies in animal models of cancers of the liver, spleen, and lungs. And clinical trials recently began in patients with liver cancer. There's still a lot of work to be done in making the targets approach just the cancer cells and not affect the production of proteins in normal cells. But as long as we're targeting the type of messenger RNA that shouldn't be there, growth factors and oncogenes, we don't have to worry about selectivity. A good example of this is a gene called KRAS. KRAS is really only present during embryologic growth. It turns off at maturity and is never, ever used again. It's been thought of as the holy grail of cancer. Mutations in KRAS create a switch that is perpetually on, causing cancer cells to divide uncontrollably. About 30% of human cancers have them, especially lung, colon, pancreatic, and thyroid. KRAS is hard to inhibit chemically because it doesn't have good sites to attach an inhibitor to. But in this case, using micro-interfering RNA, we're going upstream and preventing the KRAS from being produced. And really important, this type of therapy can be used in metastatic disease because the one thing that all of the progeny, no matter how mutated they are from the original clone of the cancer, the one thing they do have in common is this perpetually turned on KRAS gene and the growth factors that it codes for. More things than meet the eye are cropping up everywhere, even in areas we thought were a closed book, like the already sequenced genomes of the major bacteria. For infectious disease specialists, the technology of genome sequencing can be used to analyze a disease-causing bacterium and determine whether or not it will be resistant to antibiotics. But we've been looking at the DNA in the chromosome of the bacteria, and we've not been looking at critical bits of genetic information floating around in the cytoplasm. There are a variety of bits of DNA, usually in circular forms, called phages or plasmids, and these are self-replicating rings of DNA that float around in the cytoplasm of bacteria. Bacteria actually trade these phages and plasmids back and forth, and they provide information. They allow for bacterial resistance to be transmitted. And recent research also shows that they affect the pathogenicity of the disease. It's almost like a relay race, if you can imagine a bacteria that's very, very capable of infecting cells of the throat and nose and bronchial passageways. And it has the information that allows it to rapidly defeat the defense mechanisms of the mammalian respiratory tract. This information gets packaged into a phage and handed off to another bacteria of a completely different species. But now with this additional information, that bacteria is now more virulent, more capable of infecting that same tissue, maybe taking a bacterium that wasn't really a respiratory pathogen and converting it into one, at least theoretically. Within bacteria, it turns out there's a great deal of DNA that we aren't sequencing because we've been overlooking the genetic information in the cytosol. Well, our DNA control is much more complicated than that of bacteria. And understanding gene regulation is a fundamental concept. Cancers, for example, are characterized by inappropriate gene expression. Regulation and control of gene expression is very complicated. And one of the things that we've begun to learn is that most genes have multiple regulatory elements, some of which may lie 10 to 100 kilobases away from their targets. In many, if not most cases, the promoter region, which is the sort of start signal that calls the transcriptases to park on the linear DNA molecule and begin to transcribe it, this promoter region may have to interact with an enhancer that could be located as much as 100 kilobase pairs down the line, and usually at the next chromatin mark, which is where we were talking about chromatin and its importance in identifying regulatory centers in an earlier story today. Now, the implications for this also relate to mutations. So, for example, the mutation causing a disease may not be located on the genome sequence for the protein that's implicated in the disease, but instead may be a mutation in the enhancer or the promoter region. But particularly, the enhancers are significant because one enhancer may interact with multiple different promoter regions by literally looping and twisting and overlapping onto these promoter regions. And you have to ask yourself, what triggers that interaction? And is there yet another controlling factor that we've not identified that puts the enhancer and the promoter together in the first place? I mentioned earlier that in genome-wide disease association studies, we're running into the problems. Last I heard, it was up to 77 different genes implicated in breast cancer. Well, part of the problem is that some of the genes that we see may be innocent bystanders. Some of them may, in fact, be compensatory mechanisms being brought into play, particularly in the case of cancer cells. So our best bet at sorting this all out is to start deleting genes or knocking them out and seeing whether or not that makes a difference in the disease. This is particularly useful in animal models, and there's an entire industry around producing knockout mice. You can, in fact, order up a strain of mice that have had a specific gene silenced or removed. How's that possible? Well, it's because of some very amazing discoveries that have been made that allow for DNA to be edited. The most recent and arguably the most powerful of these DNA word processors that researchers now have at their disposals is a technique called CRISPR. CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, which are basically short palindromes of nucleotides that are like SOSOSOSOSOSOS. They can be read the same way backwards and forwards, but they're very recognizable. Along about 2012, these were identified to exist in bacteria, and their purpose in bacteria seems to be an acquired immunity. It's a way for bacteria to recognize bacteriophages or viruses and to cleave those foreign nucleic acids and prevent them from being replicated. Microbial CRISPR enzymes require a goal RNA, and essentially they work in a most fascinating fashion. Using goal RNA, particular loci on a genome, and by the way, you can use these bacterial enzymes on human DNA, and they work just fine. But what it does is it allows you to precisely target a place to break the strand. Once you've broken that DNA strand, you can either put in an interfering segment, or you can replace it with an edited, corrected segment. Literally, a control cut and a control paste, just like in your word processor. The initial experiment was very simple. The researchers used a version of the gene that encodes for green fluorescent protein, a glow-in-the-dark protein. First, they created a version of the green fluorescent protein gene that had a mutation in it that kept it from being a working protein. They inserted this defective gene randomly in the genome. And then they designed a guide RNA that included the tags that would allow CRISPR to attach to it, and a sequence that matched the mutant green fluorescent protein gene. They put this guide RNA into the cells and added the CRISPR gene, which is which codes for an enzyme. Once this enzyme was transcribed, it cut the genome at the site of the mutation. The cells would then repair the break, often by linking in a completely unrelated section of DNA. However, if there was an unmutated version of the green fluorescent protein gene handy, right there, then the cell would repair the break using this normal copy. And the mutation was thus eliminated, and the cells started glowing green. You can use guide RNAs to damage or repair genes, and even create small deletion mutations. This means that you could remove a toxic or mutated gene as well. Once you make a break in the DNA, you can insert an edited patch to fix a mutation, or you could selectively turn on or off the sequence. This sort of technology is getting close to being able to program the genome. One group has even figured out how to make light-activated DNA. This was a PhD student in Tokyo named Yuta Ningongaki, working with Associate Professor Moritoshi Sato in the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences of the University of Tokyo. They developed a technology to control genes with light. Using a version of CRISPR, they created a break, and then they inserted a series of genes that would turn on whatever followed them if they were exposed to light. Thus, they have now a selective promoter that you can turn on and transcribe the gene that follows it, or off, simply by taking it in or out of a light field. The most recent story I could find on CRISPR comes out of early spring, February of 2015, and this was researchers at Stanford who, using an adaptation of CRISPR by Stanford researcher Lee Stanley Chi, an assistant professor of bioengineering, they have been able to use a variation of the CRISPR molecule to include a second piece of information on the RNA, thus instructing the molecule to either upregulate or downregulate the target gene's activity, turning it on or off entirely, or simply slowing it down or speeding it up. They tested this in two mammalian genes that are important for cell mobility, and they were able to control the cell's direction and how fast it moved, almost like driving a car. Now, if all of this sounds a bit grandiose and brave new world to you, it should. We're a long way from clinical application of these technologies. However, I think that we need to understand that this is coming, and we need to think carefully about the implications and establish both regulatory oversight and a code of conduct and behavior that the researchers themselves agree upon and enforce through their peer organizations. I think it is also very important to include lethal mutations or some sort of vulnerability in the cell lines that are being used to do this research, because the potential for unintended consequences is, to say the least, vast. Now, the fact that CRISPR comes from a bacterium and is an enzyme that works perfectly well on mammalian DNA should, well, make us remember that we are all cut from the same cloth when you talk about genetics. And even though we are very different from bacteria, in effect, we carry many bacterial and viral sequences embedded within our DNA, which are never normally expressed as proteins. Crazy mixed-up cancer cells, however, may sometimes produce bacterial proteins, and this can actually be a useful therapeutic target, as in this story. Now, cancer cells produce signatures on their surface, as do all cells, but working on melanoma cancer, researchers were looking at a drug called ipilimumab, which is a monoclonal antibody. It only worked in about 50% of people. When it did work, it worked quite well, and it switched on the body's immune system to attack melanoma. Melanoma is very good at being a stealth cancer and hiding from the immune system. In trying to figure out why the drug was quite effective in some and ineffective in others, researchers at Sloan Kettering looked at the cancer DNA, and they looked for genetic mutations that would predict whether or not people responded. What they discovered was quite interesting. It appears that the mutations in the cancers that allowed this monoclonal antibody to upregulate the immune system against them were actually small bits of proteins that are normally produced by bacteria and viruses. In other words, bits of bacterial DNA, which have been embedded in the non-coding portions of the human genome, but which get turned on by those crazy mixed-up cancer cells and expressed as surface proteins. Because these monoclonal drugs are so terribly expensive, we're talking about $100,000, $150,000 for a course of treatment, it's extremely important for us to be able to know who will respond before we pull the trigger on the therapy. As we come up for air at the end of this dive into the deep science of molecular genetics, I thought I'd share with you something I at least found extremely interesting about natural blondes. Scientists have found that replacing just one letter in a key spot in the genome shifts a particular gene's activity and leads to blondness. Studies of genetic variation over the past 6 years looking at blondes versus brunettes have linked at least 8 different DNA regions based on the fact that a certain base was found in people with blonde hair but not in people with other hair colors. Some of these single nucleotide polymorphisms were in genes involved in the production of pigments, such as melanin. Other SNPs lay outside genes, but could be part of the regulatory DNA. It turns out that changes in regulatory DNA result in hair color change, but not skin color change or eye color change. This is because regulatory DNA can be selective. It can change DNA activity in just one tissue. There's a gene in Northern Europeans related to blondness. This gene is called KITLG. It's a regulatory protein that's important in development. It's also shared with a fish called a stickleback, and sticklebacks have been studied widely in biology. They grow in freshwater rivers and lakes, and depending upon the murkiness of the water, the fish have a different color. It turns out that the KITGL gene has a single nucleotide shift that determines whether or not mice, at least, will be blonde or brunette. This is the same change that causes the fish to be either light or dark. The switch doesn't turn the gene off. It actually just reduces the activity of this gene by 20%, but that's enough to create blondness versus brunette. Interestingly enough, red and black color are more clearly genetic, but blonde and brown hair is really the same hair with just a little bit more or a little bit less pigment. Now, the thing to remember about DNA is that it's a physical thing. It's a string of beads. Well, a double string of beads, right? The double helix. And if you can just imagine what happens if you take a string in your hand and start twisting it and twisting it and twisting it and twisting it and keep twisting it, it'll start to double up on itself. And then the places that have doubled up on themselves will start to double up on themselves. And you form all of these spirals. And this knot will sort of spontaneously generate. Well, that is in effect how DNA folds itself up into a chromosome. Yes, there are histones, which are little spools that provide, well, kind of a place for the DNA to supercoil around itself. But ultimately, you're talking about spiral upon spiral upon spiral upon spiral to cram the stuff down into these structures that we call chromosomes. So we already talked about how the places on the chromatin where there are markers are regulatory sites. But there's a whole other aspect to this, which is that when you have a long stretch of DNA that's coding for something, then you're going to end up having to uncoil that particular cramped up, hyper twisted piece of DNA into something that you can transcribe. And it turns out that, of course, there's an enzyme for that, and it's called topoisomerase. In fact, poisoning topoisomerase is a key way that a great number of pharmaceutical drugs work. The entire class of antibiotics called quinolones, and that includes things like levoquin and cipro, work, among other things, by interfering with bacterial topoisomerase. So the bacteria can't unwind their DNA to transcribe it. Well, that certainly takes care of that bacterium, or to a certain extent, to that cancer cell. But one of the more interesting pieces of data around autism and these genome-wide linkage tests is that if you look at the associations for autism, what you find is that a large percentage of the genes associated with autism actually are either very, very long and thus would require topoisomerase to work, or are themselves topoisomerase genes. In other words, the part of the DNA replication mechanism that unwinds DNA so that it can be reproduced is impaired in autism. Now, that's interesting in and of itself. But what is even more interesting to me is that there are a lot of factors out there in the environment that are topoisomerase inhibitors. So we haven't really figured out how autism is inherited. And in fact, autism is becoming more and more frequent in the population. There are over 300 genes linked to autism. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about a researcher whose name is Mark Zilka. He's an associate professor at the Department of Cell Biology and Physiology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He was studying a compound called topotecan. It's a topoisomerase inhibiting drug used in chemotherapy. What they discovered in studying it was that a lot of the genes that they were suppressing were incredibly long genes that were also associated with autism. Of the more than 300 genes linked to autism, over 50 are suppressed by this single topoisomerase inhibitor. Suppressing that many genes across the board means a person who is exposed to such an inhibitor during brain development could experience neurological effects equivalent to those in someone who gets autism spectrum disorder because of a single faulty gene. What we know about autism is that about 20% of these 300 genes are connected in some way to synapses, and another 20% are related to gene transcription. So between the two groups, if you have long, complicated genes that can't be unwound correctly, then the biological mechanisms between the increasingly large numbers of autism cases are at least plausibly explained by this mechanism. Now, there are a great many things in the environment that act as topoisomerase inhibitors. You can look it up on Wikipedia, and essentially, scary enough, the entire group of fluoroquinolones drops into that category. Another compound that drops into the category of potentially having an effect here is ginistin, which is a compound found in soy. And how much soy is there in the American diet, either directly or indirectly as animal feed? Many of these compounds are also found in environmental pollutants. So we know from the microRNA studies that I've been talking about earlier that things happen to the male over the course of his lifetime. And many of these things actually get embedded in the sperm. We also know from epidemiological studies that the older the father, the higher the probability of autism. I honestly believe that there is an environmental X factor here. And whether or not it is acting through topoisomerase inhibition, interfering with the formation of synapse during neonatal development, or through some other environmental mechanism, I really want to send out a precautionary message here. We need to focus on these unstudied, unproven, and ubiquitous chemicals that have been introduced into the environment in the last 50 years. Yeah, the genie is out of the bottle, and we may not be able to put the genie back in completely, but we can influence what we put in our mouths, particularly if we're planning to have children in the immediate future. And I would strongly, strongly encourage eliminating as many chemicals as you can from your diet, just on general principle, if you're planning on producing an infant. In researching for this program, I came upon a rather fantastic mechanism of our human immune system that really quite blew my mind. And this is related to the concept of DNA vaccines. So conventional vaccines are produced by composing an agent that contains either weakened or killed forms of a disease-causing microbe. This could be a virus capsid particle, like the flu vaccine, or it could be something like the polio vaccine, which is a weakened form of the polio virus. That is to say, the oral polio vaccine, which is rarely used anymore because of the potential that virus has to reactivate, and in a very small percentage of people actually cause polio. Not so good, even in a small percentage of the individuals. But this new concept for vaccination is not injecting a piece of the capsule of the virus or a weakened form of the bacteria or part of the cell wall of the bacteria to prompt our human immune system to make antibodies. This is actually injecting the DNA of a pathogenic component of the microbe, usually just one or two genes of the thing that the bacteria makes that is actually responsible for the disease process in humans. When you inject the DNA, and this blows my mind, it gets absorbed by your human immune cells, particularly the antigen-presenting cells, and they actually produce the protein inside themselves, and then take the protein and put it out on their surface to stimulate the immune system T cells to make antibodies against it. Let me repeat that. Our immune cells take bacterial DNA transcribe it into protein, and then take that protein and create an immune response against it. Now, this bypasses all kinds of problems that we have with our current vaccinations. And we're not there yet. This is not coming to you next week or next month or even next year. But in a decade, we may no longer actually have to worry about vaccine reactions or diseases caused by vaccines, because we may be able to literally program our white blood cells directly by giving them, well, a sample of the viral DNA. The image of a tracking hound dog. Here, boy, here. Here's the handkerchief. Smell it. Sniff that. Now, go get it. Go fetch. Go kill. Go get that bacteria simply by sicking our immune system on the DNA. This is new stuff. I didn't even know this was possible until I started researching for this program. And I think this is just amazing. But it's true. Our immune system is so incredibly smart that it can actually translate bacterial DNA and make antibodies against it. I know that in preparing this program for you, my head started spinning with all of the possibilities and all of the different orders of magnitude and all of the different places where DNA could be regulated, and we haven't even really gotten into some of the more obscure ones like ribosomal frame shifting and other mechanisms that just seem, well, overload. I think we're all on overload right now. But it is a brave new world with an amazing level of complexity. And the ultimate take home for me is the complication and self-organizing quality of life is so beautiful, so precious, and so amazing. I hope I've been able to share with you some of my enthusiasm for science and maybe to go a little bit deeper on some of these topics. Okay, we're going to do a couple of emails. Here's a good quick one, and I say that in quotes, from Jerry in Santa Cruz regarding Lyme disease. Can you sum it up as we currently understand it? How long does the tick need to be attached? How successful is the antibiotic treatment now? I've heard that there's a 28-day window to take antibiotics. What if the bite was years ago? Chronic symptoms, can they be treated? Well, Jerry, let's sum it up as quickly as possible. The tick probably does need to be on for 24 hours to transmit Lyme disease. The antibiotic treatment is successful, and most of the people with early Lyme disease were treated way past the 28-day window as far as antibiotic therapy is concerned. Now, if the bite is years ago and you have chronic symptoms, well, I'd say the odds are better than 50-50 that you've cleared the infection, but that it turned on your immune system and that you have a chronic immune upregulation problem. We do not understand chronic immune stimulation syndrome. We do not understand Lyme disease. And there is so much opinion out there without good science to back it up, and so much good science that's contradictory with other good science, that it's extremely confusing. I don't believe that the received wisdom is in. The jury is still out on Lyme disease. But ultimately, the first thing to do, if the bite was years ago, is get tested for IgG. And also, while you're at it, get tested for IgG against ehrlichiosis and babesiosis and anaplasma and all of the other tick-borne diseases that can cause long-term symptoms. Because what we do know is that many people who think they have chronic Lyme actually have chronic infection with some of these other organisms. And when you clear those, often you clear what's making the person miserable. A real quickie going out to Lorianne in San Leandro regarding Meniere's disease of flight attendant. Hello, Dr. Dawn. I'm not sure what amazes me more, your scope of knowledge or your degree of patience with the people who call into your show. I'm writing to ask you about Meniere's disease. My sister, a flight attendant, has avoided surgery so far and managing it fairly well with supplements and by cutting back on salt. Do you have any advice for her? And would you be interested in knowing which supplements she's been taking? Sincerely, Lorianne. Well, Lorianne, I was intrigued by the concept that there was a special kind of Meniere's disease for flight attendants. It seems to me that Meniere's disease, typically considered to be a swelling of the basement membrane that holds the sensors in the semicircular canals, was an idiopathic condition. But I came across this article in the September 2005 issue of Archives of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery, Volume 131, that I wanted to throw out there to everyone. These researchers had a bunch of flight attendants who suffered from Meniere's disease, which is paroxysmal dizziness with ringing in the ears and often nausea and vomiting. They treated them with an antifungal nasal spray at a very low dose, amphotericin B, at 0.01%, and had a very substantial improvement in the symptoms after about a 6 to 8 week course. This may be some kind of odd infectious disease that people who spend large amounts of their time on airplanes are more subject to. Maybe something that grows in the filters. Who knows? But anyway, it's a very low dose and a very benign thing to try at that dose. So there you go. Give it a shot. It can't hurt and it might help. Please let me know if it's successful. You could bring it to the attention of her doctor. The citation is right there. Good luck. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. I'll be back next week to take your calls and read your emails.